I'm standing in the middle of the White City estate, and Bentworth Road, where my mum comes from, is about less than half a mile behind me. My dad, to the south on Norland Gardens. That was our family home until they knocked it down and built a motorway. My family moved out, but this is where we came back to, because this is where I think of as home. For as long as I remember, it's been an odd mix. The BBC's been here, lots of warehouses and car breakers. But 100 years ago, the White City was, for 6 months, the most wonderful place on the planet. In 1908, something extraordinary happened in the quiet West London suburb of Shepherd's Bush. It was called the Franco-British Exhibition.
French people came across the Channel on special excursions.
They did things like juggling and tumbling, snake charming, of course.
And it was a spectacular enterprise, like nothing we could possibly see today. A bold combination of trade show, fun fair, and an exercise in imperial self-congratulation. There's absolutely nothing left of the exhibition now. But we can know the thoughts of millions of ordinary people who went there. All thanks to a unique, informal record that exists in an unlikely form. Picture postcards.
Dear Annie, Mother and I went yesterday. It is a delightful place. All the buildings are pure white and they shine splendidly in the sun. Goodbye now. Much love to all. From Gertie.
If you were to see this at night, you would never want to leave it. It's a dream.
The hub of London, Shepherd's Bush.
Yes, that's
now,
right.
You know, as I'm a boy from this neighbourhood...
Well, quite. You would agree with that.
I would know it. That touches my heartstrings.
What I think I like about the pictures in the...
Jane Kimber is the borough archivist for Hammersmith and Fulham. She was impressed by the way the White City mushroomed.
It sort of sprung up almost from nowhere in this part of Shepherd's Bush, which was really just farmland, and was built incredibly quickly. I mean, you've got the first turf was cut in January 1907, and in May 1908, only 16 months later, this incredible, almost like a city, had arrived.
Can you describe the White City in 1908?
Yes, I think it really did have the wow factor. I mean, you came in through wonderful entrance gates or arches, and then you walked through and immediately you saw this incredible vista of not only buildings, which were beautiful in themselves because they were covered with white painted plaster and they looked sort of rather like Indian architecture, but also water features. So you had cascades, you had lagoons, you had, you know, all those kind of things, and people floating around on little boats, some of which were shaped like swans. And then further on you had the fairground attractions, and right at the end of the site, the northern part of the site, you had the native villages that had been recreated.
The scale of it was enormous.
It was very big, and it really does seem to me that it would have been quite tiring to walk around the entire site.
Dear Jeannie, I do wish you could see this exhibition. It's a perfect wonder. Ed and I have walked miles in it today and cannot tell you what we have seen. Love to all, Amy.
The Franco-British was the latest in a line of international exhibitions, starting really with the Great Exhibition of 1851, the Crystal Palace in Hyde Park. Then there were major exhibitions in Paris in 1889 and 1900, Antwerp 1885, Chicago 1893, and Turin in 1902. There was always considerable rivalry between the participating nations, but the Franco-British was specifically held in a spirit of cooperation.
The principal aim of the exhibition was to combine a display of the best of French and British industry and commerce with a sense of fun.
Martin Cornick is Professor of French Cultural History at the University of Birmingham. He's made a particular study of Anglo-French relations at the time.
The Entente Cordiale originally was an agreement signed in April 1904 between the French and the British governments to try to settle some differences between the two nations over colonies. It was quite a minor affair, really. But in the aftermath of the Entente, it was agreed that there should be an event to mark the rapprochement between the two nations. And it was the French Chamber of Commerce during 1905 which set the ball rolling, really, to get an exhibition prepared. And that was when the commissioner for the exhibition, Imre Kiralfi, was brought into the arrangements.
Imre Kiralfi was a Hungarian impresario who'd been thrust into show business as a child, performing flamboyant folk dances with his brother. As the Kiralfi brothers, they toured the Austro-Hungarian Empire, becoming favourites of European royalty. Eventually, they pitched up in London, where they began to choreograph and produce stage spectaculars. In his autobiographical notes, Kiralfi tells the tale of how he came up with the idea for the White City.
One night, I lay awake in bed, and as if by magic, I saw stretched out in my mind's eye an imposing city of palaces, domes and towers, set in cool green spaces and intersected by many bridged canals. But it had one characteristic, which made it strangely beautiful. Hitherto I had dealt in colour, in the shimmering hues of gold and silver. This city was spotlessly white. I saw it all in an instant, and the next day I jotted down the scheme of what London was to know as the White City.
It has to be said that Kiralfi, ever the showman, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. His account of conceiving the White City in a dream, well, it may have been somewhat embellished, and his inspiration could have come from elsewhere.
It's certainly the case that Kiralfi himself had been to the World's Columbian Exhibition held in Chicago in 1893, which had also been the White City, the Great White City. And I think that Kiralfi certainly was heavily influenced by that.
Dream or not, the White City became a reality. A small army of men were put to work constructing the buildings on the 140-acre site, 4,000 working by day and 2,000 by night under electric light. This huge and very public enterprise fast became the talk of London.
27th of April, 1908. I hope you forgive me for not coming yesterday. Had a splitting headache. In the afternoon, I walked to see the exhibition buildings. They're not near finished. It looks like a great white city. Love to all, Sid.
One of the principal aims of the exhibition was the idea of encouraging peace between the nations. Universal peace was indeed a slogan that appears on some of the postcards which were on sale.
5th of October 1908. Dear Albert, hope to see you at 7:45 p.m. tonight, but don't bring any French girls round, please. Nell.
I mean, if you think about it, if you were, it's a bit before my father's, my grandfather certainly would have been living there then. This thing must have been extraordinary. You're living in essentially a slum in a very rundown part of London. And this collection of palaces grows up 100 yards from your house.
That's right. I don't know what people thought of it, really, but it wasn't that cheap to enter, so you had to pay a shilling,
right. Which
for a working person might have been a fair amount of money,
yeah.
I think. So whether they sort of looked on it and weren't able to go in, I'm not sure. But
they probably found a way of bunking in, I would imagine.
I would think so, family. Yes. I'm sure there are ways you could get through the fence.
It's a big fence to guard.
Quite.
I'm in the foyer of a hotel in Bloomsbury here in central London for a monthly event. It's the Bloomsbury Collectors' Fair, and particularly the postcard section that we're going to head to. You've got an exhibition section here.
Well, yeah, I've got a few. Right.
Let's have a look in here, see if I can find anything. 1908. Here you go. Australian Pavilion, Franco-British Exhibition, London, 1908. Straight away. Nothing written on that one, though.
Let's start from the beginning.
Is Franco-British a popular area?
Not the more common ones. The more unusual ones, yes, but the more common ones, you know, they're very hard to sell. The ones we say at 50p, 75 pence.
That's what these cost.
Yeah.
For a
bit
of history,
you can imagine
really?
Something's 100 years old, it's 50 pence. So.
And they're beautiful. I mean, they're intrinsically very beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
I think the real thing I'm getting from this fair is the role that postcards must once have played in people's lives. This is almost like you've got a collection of contemporary kind of emails in card form. It was a means of communication. It was something to send, to collect. They must have just been really, really important in a way that we can't imagine now.
25th of August, 1908. Dear Mrs. Waugh, many thanks for your nice card. If you're in London on Saturday, I should be pleased to see you at 7:15 in the middle of the centre bridge of the Court of Honour. If this is convenient, shall be glad to have a card. Yours, Percy.
It's wonderful, isn't it, to have an image from 100 years ago of somewhere perhaps you live now that has changed.
Liz McKendrick is from the Postcard Traders Association.
In 1906 time, there were 850 million going through the post in that year.
Wow.
And there were 7 deliveries a day. So you could write a postcard in the morning and say, I'm coming to tea this afternoon, and your postcard would get there before you did.
But do you ever read what people have written or not?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I'm afraid so, yes. You can get very waylaid looking at the backs of cards, yes.
I'm having my bulldog sent by train from Ammerford on Friday. Will you tell someone to open the basket and give her a drink when she arrives? She's quiet, but they should mind she does not get away. She'll be all right in the basket till we come. Her name is Brat.
And I had no idea, A, that there were so many, or B, that there were so many people out there collecting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a whole society just to do with the exhibitions, and they all collect the postcards, because the postcards are the images of the exhibition. I mean, you didn't go around with a camera and take photographs. You bought the postcards when you went.
But if you look closely enough at some of those images, it becomes apparent that they may not be the truest representation of what things actually looked like.
Oh, yes. You see lots of cards where, instead of people walking about, there's obviously artist-drawn figures of people.
Bill Tonkin from the Exhibition Study Group has the world's largest collection of White City postcards.
The early cards were very often very crude. You know, a long pathway would be all painted in brown, lawns would all be painted green, but there was no looking and seeing the blades of grass on the green at all. So they did replace them as soon as they could with real photographs.
And it turns out that the palaces on the postcards were themselves often not much more than fancy facades. Jane Kimber again.
They clearly were structures that could be built very quickly, and they were made of steel. They were basically steel frames covered with a fireproof fibrous plaster, and then all these wonderful sort of plaster mouldings, and all painted white, of course, and very dazzling. We know that in sunny weather, you know, it was almost blinding to look at these buildings.
It's always sunny weather as well in postcards.
Yes, they wanted to sell postcards with a beautiful sunny sky, so they paint in. I've got one card. I've got 10 different cloud patterns to it.
I can see them here, yeah. You see, looking from these cards, I would have assumed that the weather in Shepherd's Bush was always good.
Well, that was the impression they wanted to give.
Dear Slope, shan't be down tomorrow. After all, weather absolutely rotten here. If it rains tomorrow, she'll stop at home. Don't be downhearted. We'll see you soon as poss. T.
Let's look at the reception and the opening of this grand event.
Well, that was covered very extensively, actually, and mostly people were quite excited about it, and particularly about the political angle, the entente cordiale. And then there were very long reports about the actual opening itself, and there was a lot of music. A choir of 700 people sang the national anthem, which must have been quite something to hear.
Do you have any exhibition cards? Do you have an exhibition section? Excellent, thank you. First one, Louis XV Pavilion, Franco-British Exhibition, 1908, £2.50. And there's a huge pile of them here. This is a whole world that I just didn't know existed. And it does seem that the Franco-British Exhibition, whenever you get a pile of these exhibition cards, I'm becoming an expert now, that the Franco-British one is the predominant one. That, you know, White City is the one. You get a few from others, but by far and away, most of the cards come from the White City. I mean, it just looks so fantastic in that. I mean, there's a picture there of, you know, of this gleaming White City around a lake. I want to go there.
It was time to revisit the White City, to walk where the crowds of straw-boated and umbrella-wielding Edwardians had once promenaded. The years have not been kind to the White City, it's got to be said, but I wanted to see if 100 years on, I could still capture just a whiff of the splendour it must once have been.
This is White City.
And what else are we going to get? We're going to get hard hats and...
Going to get hard hats, you need a high-vis jacket or vest.
Part of the area is now a building site. A massive construction project is underway to build a shopping centre. Duncan Bauer from the developers Westfield kitted me out.
How big is the actual site?
It's 43 acres. As you probably know, being a former resident of this area, that lots of railway land, taxis used to get registered over here. So it's a real mixed bag after the exhibition. And this whole area is now defined as an opportunity area under the London plan.
Don Knight, White City enthusiast and author of the booklet The Great White City, joined us on the tour.
So, Don, we're here by what would have been the grand entrance to the White City. I mean, it's currently a building site and a bus resting place, and there's work going on all around us. But once, this would have been the archway, and I remember that arch for years and years. It was an archway to nowhere when I used to know it, but once it was an archway to the grandest exhibition London had ever seen.
Yes, the exhibition covered 140 acres, and the people, after paying their shilling, would have seen exhibits from France and Britain.
And how many people a day would have come through here?
By the time the exhibition closed, there were 8,400,000 people paid to come into the exhibition.
Wow! That's a lot of shillings.
That was a lot of money.
And those shillings came from far and wide.
French people came across the Channel on special excursions. There were excursion trains from the north of England.
Martin Cornick again.
There were special franking machines at the exhibition, and one could send single or sets of postcards to friends who were collectors. This was certainly the golden age of the postcard.
I am sending you just a card to let you see we are really here. The exhibition is very grand. Crowds of people here. London, a very busy place. Traffic deafening.
28th of May, 1908. I thought I must send you a card from here. It's the most wonderful place, and so full of foreigners, I feel in another country.
Take me on the flip, let the
At last, I have been able to see this for you. The tallest form of entertainment.
How would you like to be swung up 200 feet in these cages and then put down in a different place?
These great arms cross each other at a great height and lower slowly down.
We were in the top cage, 200 feet from the ground. Hundreds of people there. Love from Edie.
So, Don, we've come up in this hoist contraption to the very top of the building. This is not as high as the Flick Flack would have been, but it must be a similar sort of view to the one that people got.
Yes, from the height of it, they could see Windsor Castle to the north and the towers at Crystal Palace to the south.
Well, I can't quite see them, but I can see my grandma's house, which is handy. I guess the nearest equivalent we've got now is the London Eye, isn't it? It was something like that.
Something like that. You were in a carriage with 48 people after paying sixpence to go into it. And you came up into the air, reaching a height of 150 feet, and you may well have felt a little bit queasy by the time you got the other side.
I'm feeling a little bit queasy already myself. Maybe we should get back down.
Having a ripping time. Just been on the flip-flap. Love, Lucy.
So, Dom, we've now shed our hard hats, left the building site, crossed the road, and we're in front of BBC Television Centre, an iconic building in its own right.
This was the Court of Honour.
This is the one that you see most in postcards. It's so incredibly ornate. You've got this vast lake and then these sort of Baroque buildings going out over it, and you've got boats with people sailing on it. It must have been an absolute sight to behold.
Yes, I'd love to have been there.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain that my Nan and Grandad would not just have been there, but would have been doing their courting. They got married about a year after it opened, were from this area. No doubt they'd have walked hand in hand along this.
This part is all lit up by thousands of lights. It puts you in mind of pictures of Venice. Love from Edie.
Don, at last we're sitting down, and I'm quite literally, I mean, I'm a bit footsore. We've just walked about half a mile from Television Centre up to the new BBC building that's on the site of the old White City Stadium. And we haven't even mentioned that as well as all the exhibition site, there was also a stadium here in the Olympics.
Yes, so 1906, the Italians who were going to hold the 1908 Olympics found that they couldn't because there had been an eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Britain was asked if we would stage the Olympics. So they built it into the White City site.
I mean, this must have been an extraordinary... I'm just trying to think. A, the scale of it is almost unbelievable. I mean, this is a huge slice of West London. And if you think about it, you've got an Olympic stadium, the biggest exhibition grounds. I mean, it was kind of like a pleasure palace for London, wasn't it? But it's almost a forgotten story. I mean, people now don't remember... Well, obviously, they don't remember this. There can't be very many alive who remember it, but...
There's nobody now alive that will remember it.
You see, I hadn't forgotten to send you a postcard. Did you hear of the awful accident that happened at this exhibition last week? Explosion of a balloon. Love to all, from Agnes.
Somebody called Captain Lovelace had this little airship which he wanted to fly above the White City site. And while he was preparing for the flight, there was this terrible explosion. And unfortunately, his private secretary, who was a young woman of 21, and two of the men helping him were very badly burnt. And she died instantly, and the two other men, I'm afraid, died in hospital. Oh. So it was a very unpleasant incident. And I think if you read the reports in the Times, it's clear that it was a kind of health and safety disaster waiting to happen.
Dom, we're now by the Westway, I guess one of the most famous kind of arterial roads in all London. We're also about 100 yards from where my mum lived, my nan's house. I didn't even know that this was still part of the site.
Yes, part of it was the Ballymacclinton village.
Oh, that's really famous. I've seen loads of pictures of the pretty colleens.
Yeah, lovely. They had a fire brigade, they made lace, and all the profits went back to Ireland to fight consumption. Just next to that was the Ceylon village and the Indian village.
I am sending you a picture which I have just bought from an Indian woman. Tell Daddy to expect me at 8:30 on Tuesday. With love from Mother.
Dear Flo, this Ceylon village is very interesting. Don't know if you came in here. Excuse scrawl, I'm writing this with crowd around. The people here are very beautiful, with jewellery about their feet and hands. Love, NC.
I think it's very interesting how they recreated these villages, bringing people over from the countries of origin. And you get these wonderful photographs where you see people in their native costume doing crafts or activities, and then suddenly you see a sort of fire bucket at the back of the photograph and a fence, and you realise that behind the fence is Wood Lane, and it all sort of brings back down to earth. In the Indian arena, they had these special shows, and rather like sort of circus shows. And one of the things they did was they sent two elephants to slide down a steep slope, and then they plunged into a tank of water at the bottom. And there was a letter to the Times saying, I beg to appeal for your support in a protest which I made yesterday against the closing item in the performance in the Indian arena. There is something degrading in seeing so dignified and intelligent an animal treated as a mere means of provoking thoughtless and heartless laughter.
But nobody's complaining about seeing Indians semi-naked in a rather cold English summer for our entertainment.
No, that's strange, because I do think that they must have been terribly cold and they must have suffered a good deal, I would think.
October 31, 1908. Dear Jeff, the last day of the exhibition. Here's a reminder from Dan.
Towards the end of the evening, a few people got a bit boisterous and started throwing things, you know, into the pools and the lagoons and so on. And there was a rather comic scene because some of the policemen weren't familiar with the site. And occasionally they would arrest somebody and they would try to march him off the site and expel him. And they couldn't actually find the exits because it was a large, confusing site. And people were sort of laughing and cheering as they walked around desperately in each direction looking for one of the exit gates. So, but it was on the whole quite a peaceful end to the exhibition. exhibition, and, you know, a cheerful one with a great many people there.
I think the White City stands as a genuine attempt to spread international peace and understanding through the medium of the exhibition. The real tragedy of the exhibition and all those young people who went to see it in 1908 was that the war and the mud obliterated many of those hundreds of thousands of young men who had passed through the gates of the White City. There is a French postcard printed and distributed towards the end of 1914, and it shows two female allegorical figures, and the slogan at the bottom of the card says, "Remember the Entente Cordiale, remember the exhibition."
I'm standing on Bentworth Road, which for 40-odd years is where my nan lived and my Aunt Joyce and where my mum was brought up. And I'm actually finding this quite moving. I had no idea that on this site was once an Indian village with fakirs and elephants and thousands of people coming to be entertained. I mean, it's a humble little council house. And once it was magnificent. I mean, not everything was as it seemed at the White City. It was a show. It was illusion and fantasy and dreams. The palaces weren't really palaces. They were still sheds. Imre Kuralfy didn't even invent the idea of a White City. But he did build one. And the 8 million people who came here, they were real. And the millions of postcards that they sent home, they were real too. And if the pictures printed on them, well, maybe they were composed and a bit of blue sky was added. Doesn't matter. The messages were from the heart. I'm now writing my own postcard from the White City. I think I've got to adapt the old cliche. I hope you're well. The White City is magnificent. I wish I'd been there. Love from Robert.
The music in postcards from the White City included the Franco-British Exhibition by Oscar Verne and Round the Exhibition by Ezra Reed, which was specially arranged by Joe Atchison. The programme was produced by Tom Jackson and was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4.